Our next presenter is Kevin Maloney. Kevin is a physical therapist for Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. But I like him better because he's actually a certified athletic trainer as well. So he's got a dual role. He's very valuable to us in a lot of things that he does. He understands the athletic training side of it because he was part of that as well. So, and I think that's a great combination. Kevin's done a lot of, he's very young. He's just really out of school about 5-6 years. Got his bachelor's from Westchester, Illinois in 2010. Got his doctorate in physical therapy in 2014. He got to Houston in 2015 where he did our physical therapy residency program. And he did so well that they kept him. So he is certified in a number of different things, you know, all these subspecialties anymore, but he's sports certified with the American Physical Therapy Association. He's trained in blood flow restrictions, which is that's an interesting topic too. I don't know if we're talking about that today, but he's in dry needling. He likes to stick the needles in people. He even tried to entice me one day to do that to me, but I haven't caved in yet. He's obviously licensed as an athletic trainer. He's certified as an athletic trainer as well as physical therapist in the state of Texas and Florida. He's an adjunct faculty member in our MAT program at the University of Houston. I shouldn't say ours, but in the MAT program. And he's a site coordinator for our residency program within our Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. My honor to present Kevin, and Kevin's going to talk to us about the rehab toolbox, kind of an update on modalities and things that are out there for you.
Thanks, Brad. Can you all hear me okay? All right, great. So my presentation today is the rehab toolbox and update on modalities. Although I will reference specific products or brands, I have no conflicts of interest or disclosures. I'm not being paid by any of these products to endorse them or discuss their claims. So the objectives for today is I want to identify modalities utilized in rehab and athletic training room settings, discuss the specific modality theory, physiology, and application, and then give you an update on the evidence and the research behind them. So injury preventing and performance enhancing tools can rapidly gain widespread popularity in today's society, whether it be related to the media or just our culture's desire for like the latest technology and advancing health. But unfortunately, as medical professionals, we have a small problem on our hands. These tools will always outpace our scientific research. So today we're going to open up our toolbox and examine the dry needling, cupping, percussion massage tools or the Theragun, and then blood flow restriction training. So first we're gonna start with just like the first thing I had mentioned, the passive treatment-based interventions. So dry needling. In 2013, the American Physical Therapy Association defined dry needling as a skilled intervention that utilizes a thin filiform needle to penetrate the skin and muscle tissue and the connective tissue for the management of neuromusculoskeletal pain and movement dysfunctions. It's been used on all these different anatomical locations, including trigger points, scar tissue, fascia, perineural, ligaments, tendons, and bones. Dry needling does not, I'm gonna make this very clear, it does not rely on like a Chinese or Oriental medicine diagnosis, and also does not attempt to move like qi along the meridians, such as acupuncture. If I move your qi along a meridian, you're welcome, but that was not my actual intent with this treatment. So one of the most widely known uses for dry needling is when managing these myofascial trigger points. So over the next two slides, we'll talk about the local physiology and then move towards the central mechanism behind dry needling. So the goal is that when you do a deep dry needling, you can inactivate these local these myofascial trigger points through a local twitch response. What we found is that obtaining a local twitch response is the goal, as it results in rapid depolarization of the involved muscle fibers by alleviating and mitigating the spontaneous electrical activity at the motor endplate. Also, it's been found that you can decrease the concentration of numerous nociceptor, inflammatory, and immune system-related chemicals. You can also increase the local circulation. And why that's important is because low blood flow to myofascial trigger points has actually been associated with myofascial pain syndrome. So improving the local blood flow would theoretically decrease the pain intensity and increase the pain pressure threshold, which is the amount of pain tolerance that the athlete can actually endure. All these things are thought to like relax the tight band. However, there's been numerous research studies that have actually examined the physical examination is not the best way to identify a myofascial trigger point. So my way of identifying a myofascial trigger point is very different than Ben, our 21-year-old master's in athletic training students, which is very different than Brian Duncan, a well-skilled clinician. Unfortunately, there's too much variability in palpation skills to actually identify these trigger points. So while we do have a physiological change, we're actually not that great and reliable at actually treating these. When moving into other uses, so scar tissue, tendon, and ligaments, scar tissue has been linked to myofascial pain and fibroblasts, which are very important in synthesizing, organizing, and remodeling collagen. We know that with scar tissue, the collagen is displaced and these fibroblasts infiltrate, but the structure is not packed as densely. There's new, less stiff collagen, there's fat cells, there are new blood vessels, and unfortunately, it makes the tissue more likely to be re-injured. So when we're talking about what the research has found in terms of needling with rotation, it actually can place these fibroblasts on tension. And we've all seen these pictures up on the left side of your screen, these nice and neatly organized fibers, and then moving to the right side of the screen, this wavy scar tissue appearance. When you stick a needle in and rotate it, you place these fibroblasts on tension. What that does is increases the collagen proliferation, and that helps to improve the scar tissue alignment and pain. It's been through the same physiology that you can utilize this for tendinopathy, so you can help improve the vasodilation and the collagen proliferation. So looking into like the central mechanisms, which have been a little bit more plainly stated in the research. Firstly, the mechanical stimulus of dry needling can help increase the A-beta fiber transmission, so effectively activating the gate control theory of pain that we're all familiar with. Additionally, through this mechanical stimulus of introducing a needle into the skin, there is a activation of the descending pain inhibitory system. So the cortex, hypothalamus, and brainstem are all activated. You also get inactivation of the limbic system, and all of these have been shown on fMRI and PET scans. So similar to other pain modulating mechanisms like manual therapy, there's a slight increase in endogenous opioid and serotonin, like analgesic release. Additionally, we know that when you actually get a local twitch response on, say, the left upper trap, you actually get a similar result of a local twitch response on the right upper trap. So there's a central mechanism going on. You're getting a unilateral afferent stimulus and getting a bilateral efferent output, which is extremely exciting, knowing that we are affecting then more just the muscle. We're getting the whole spinal cord involved, the whole neural reflex complex. So if you're scared of needles, we're going to get into applications to look away. First is pistoning, which is a rhythmic up and down motion, just looking for that local twitch response. Then we get into the winding and rotating. So it's twisting the needle clockwise. This is until like a tightening sensation is felt. And then I'm going to lift the tissue and actually get a stretching. So that is effectively trying to wrap the collagen around the needle like a fork in pasta. That actually allows you to lift the tissue and separate it from the underlying skin. Next, we move into the electrical stimulation. You can use it with a unit that has alligator clips to clip onto the needle, or you can actually just use a little handheld probe to stimulate the needle. And it's been thought that through the electrical stimulation unit, you can have endocrinological changes, so you can increase the beta endorphins and a decrease in cortisol. When Chris Shields comes and presents to you guys tomorrow on concussions, please tell him to work out a little bit, because I couldn't get a local twitch response. Unfortunately, he suffers from dad bod, so he doesn't quite have the muscle tone, and he doesn't use them enough to actually get me a good twitch on either one of the pistoning and then also the electrical stimulation. So this is an ultrasound-guided dry needling, because this is what me and Dexter Upton do for fun on our Saturday nights. So what you see here is a medial gastroc head. The left side of the screen with that thin needle, with a thin arrow, is actually the needle running diagonally. And then looking globally towards the right side of the screen, you'll see the local twitch response occur. So the needle's going out, it's going to come back in, and you'll see a little explosion. Poof. And we got another one coming back up. Everyone see it? Okay. So there is something physiologically happening here. So now I want to discuss what the best research for dry needling has actually discussed in terms of applying this modality. So frequency, the times per week or month. The research has utilized a variety of frequencies, some one time a week for 3 weeks, taking an off week, and then repeating one time a week for 3 weeks. Some research has used it for just twice, for a couple times a week, or sometimes just once to look at the acute effects. Unfortunately, there's been too much diversity in the literature to have actually found an effect. So we don't know what frequency is the best to utilize this modality at. In terms of duration of utilizing this treatment, we want to identify the length of the treatment. So for pistoning, they've seen 60 seconds. They've seen until a local twitch response has occurred. They've seen it until when you're manipulating the needle, you can leave it in there for 10 minutes, or with e-stim, 10 to 20 minutes. Unfortunately, once again, there's been too much diversity in the literature to actually find a positive effect size to see how long we're actually supposed to be doing this modality on our patients for. In terms of the intensity of the needling, it's like how many needles you're actually going to be utilizing. A lot of the research says they're going to use it per the clinician's discretion. Well, my discretion is very different than another therapist's, so we aren't quite sure how many needles to actually utilize. In terms of manipulating the needle, some research actually has them only twisting the needle twice in terms of manipulating. Other times they turn it until that resistance is felt, as I demonstrated in that second video. However, in terms of actually utilizing this, they're not sure which is the actual best intensity for utilizing this modality. So once again, we're getting more and more questions without any answers on how to apply this. When going into the technique, of those three different types of needling that I had just demonstrated, there's been minimal systematic or repeated trials that have actually shown to be which is the most effective. So we still don't know what technique to utilize. And then lastly, so the population. We've seen this utilized in various populations, patients with shoulder pain following a stroke, plantar fasciopathy, triceps tendinopathy. We have all these seemingly orthopedic conditions that it's been trialed on. However, none of them have actually demonstrated an effect size to actually be of clinical value. So we don't actually know who is going to respond to this treatment. So unfortunately, the low quality methodology and the diversity of needling styles has clinicians kind of scratching their heads. How best do I apply this to my patient? The current literature of systematic reviews, randomized controlled trials, and case studies leave too many variables on the table. So different organizations that provide dry needling certifications like KineticCore and Spinal Manipulative Institute, they teach different styles of needling based off of their best impression of the research. So I wanted to discuss what the actual research is saying. So this systematic review and meta-analysis back in 2009 over acupuncture and dry needling, concluded 7 studies, and it found that needling was not more significantly better than standard care. They found that a lot of the research out there had limited sample size and unfortunately poor quality. In 2015, a systematic review in the Journal of Manual and Manipulative Therapy by Boyles et al. Concluded that the majority of high quality studies included in this review demonstrated that there is a benefit of utilizing trigger point dry needling for myofascial trigger points in multiple body areas, suggesting that there's a broad applicability of trigger point dry needling in the treatment of multiple muscle groups. Unfortunately, in 2016 of that same article, Veneer and Ridgway wrote an article responding to this conclusion stating that... Sorry, guys. Has that been off the whole time? Okay, sorry. So unfortunately, in 2016, Ridgway and Veneer wrote an article responding to this conclusion stating that there is no difference between dry needling and sham treatments. The strongly worded conclusion before overstates the finding of what the actual data says. The studies had a short-term outcomes within 72 hours, and there was no clinically relevant effects on pain or disability. So in summary, there has been physiological changes in the research, but there is an insufficient and high-level evidence to actually support the use of dry needling due to minimal meaningful clinical change in patient outcomes. So I'd like to get into cupping. So it's a traditional Chinese medicine that utilizes a glass or a plastic cup. It utilizes heat from fire or a pneumatic pump that creates a negative pressure environment inside the cup to create a suctioning effect, thought to lift the superficial skin and underlying fascia. And then the tissues are drawn and held up into a cup with up to a pressure of 45 to 60 millimeters of mercury. In terms of application, unfortunately, there has been no validated research on it. And so the previous parameters have been described at 5 to 15 minutes for about once a week. Although we're unsure of the exact mechanisms behind how cupping actually can do its job, there are a couple small randomized controlled trials that have described a couple leading theories. In terms of metabolic changes, the vasodilation observed through that petechia, that superficial capillary bursting that produces those bruisings, is thought to increase the microcirculation. And as I discussed with the dry needling, when you have that microcirculation increase, it increases the pain pressure threshold, so the athlete's able to tolerate pain better. It's also thought that through the peripheral nociceptor stimulation of the tissue being drawn up, you can have an alteration in lactate, ATP, and cytokines that increase the sensitivity of nociceptors. In terms of neuronal changes, these are actually the same mechanisms for dry needling. It's the gate control theory of pain and descending pain inhibition. So by utilizing this cup, you can get tensile stress to the tissue that can stimulate these A beta fibers that can cause the nociceptive interference and this counter irritant mechanism of pain. So it activates that inhibitory neural pathways. So more or less that just the mechanical stress of tissue is actually resulting in some sort of pain inhibition. When looking into the research, there was a 2018 systematic review that looked at 11 trials with a population of about 500 professional athletes across various sports teams. The results demonstrated mild improvements in terms of perceptions of pain and disability. They've also demonstrated mild increases in range of motion and decreased perceptions of pain and disability. However, there was little short-term follow-up, and there's also concurrent or additional modalities used at the time. So they were using multiple interventions to manage pain in these athletes. Unfortunately, all trials had unclear or high risk of bias, and then the heterogeneous study designs throughout each of the trials led to minimal important clinical guidelines on how we're actually supposed to utilize cupping. Additionally, in 2015, a systematic review with meta-analysis on traditional Chinese medicine interventions identified that for patients with chronic neck pain, there had been moderate strength in with evidence that is more effective than typical usual care than being on a wait list. So they found is doing cupping is actually better than just being on a wait list waiting for an actual intervention. So it's not that important to me at this time, but knowing that touching a patient is actually better than just leaving them on the wait list. In regards to patients with chronic low back pain, there's been one large study with moderate evidence that demonstrated that cupping to be more effective than usual care. However, there has been little minimal change in actual physiology in that study. So what we're seeing is kind of mixed results here. We have some possible physiologic changes, however, in only one tissue-specific body region, the chronic low back pain, that actually might benefit from cupping at this time. All right, so moving into the Therion. It's a percussive massage tool that provides vibration therapy and features a frequency of 33 to 40 hertz, as well as an amplitude of half an inch. The frequency equates to around 2,000 to 2,500 revolutions per minute, which is pretty substantial. And it's thought that the amplitude can replicate a deep tissue massage. However, the frequency of the repeated revolutions per minute can actually decrease the pain or pressure experienced by the athlete. So more or less, they can tolerate a deep massage better. There are other massage tools out there that have different variants in frequency. However, no research has been done on what frequency is the best. So whether it be this model at 2,000 to 2,500, or whether it be the Hyperice Hypervolt, which has 3,200 percussions per minute, we're not quite sure. In terms of application, the website claims that the slower you go, the better you are at getting your results. Ideally moving it around 1 inch per second over the involved body, and then around 60 to 90 seconds for up to 3 times a day. The next couple of quotes are just taken from the actual website itself. So it's thought that the Theragun uses a unique combination of frequency and amplitude that inhibits the brain from sensing pain signals from muscle, allowing deeper and longer muscle treatment. Additionally, the increased muscle blood flow caused by the Theragun produces numerous benefits for patients, such as increased mobility, stretching of the muscle, and removing knots and cramps. And lastly, it drives blood flow and oxygen to the injured or recovering area, which drives lactic acid away, resulting in a looser joint. It also has been alleged to break up scar tissue, improve lymphatic flow, and activate and resetting the nervous system. However, there's only been one article that has actually investigated the effects of vibration or percussion massage. It utilized a 50 hertz frequency, so something a little bit higher than the model that I discussed, and it was done before participating in eccentric biceps training. So what it found and what it theorized is that the vibration can stimulate the muscle spindles that increase the activation of afferent activity, which has a gate control theory mechanism of pain. And then the authors gathered that from a previous study, the vibration frequency can increase the background tension and motor unit activation synchronization in the vibrated muscles that can prevent sarcoma disruption and damage to excitation contraction coupling that occurs with eccentric exercise. So theoretically, it can decrease damage potential and thus less pain following exercise. The article did find a minimal reduction in pain after utilizing this following exercise. However, a non-significant decrease in lactate dehydrogenase, which is just a common byproduct of exercise that they use to assess how well the muscles are recovering. So clinically, the patients are saying, I have a little bit less pain. Physiologically, it's not quite backed up in terms of the metabolic byproduct. So to get the effects that I had previously mentioned, I assume that the developers just took some loose theories, conjectures, or any results of actual massage therapy and how they got a change in lymphatic flow and resetting the nervous system simply because it has not been updated in the literature at this time. So in summary, there has been physiological changes demonstrated in the research, minimally, and minimal changes in the actual patient reports. So it kind of just leaves us scratching our head. Is this something I actually utilize? I'd say, yeah, go ahead and utilize it, because the patient's saying I'm a little bit better. However, physiologically, maybe not the most up-to-date literature on what it's actually doing. Lastly, I'd like to get into the exercise-based intervention I'll discuss, which is blood flow restriction training. So this became, in the 1960s in Japan, it gained a lot of popularity from there and spread westward. So while the novelty of the device might be the reason for its widespread surge in use, what keeps people talking about it is that its substantial support on research-based, currently hypothesized exercise physiology principles. So the premise is that you're taking out a little oxygen, but you're following the same physiological pathways in exercise. And that's kind of quoted by Johnny Owens, who's the founder of the Owens Recovery Science and one of the frontier researchers for blood flow restriction training use in the United States. So one big attraction to its popularity is that using a tourniquet to restrict blood flow while participating in low load resistance training can provide a significant gain of muscle mass or strength, similar to that of high load resistance training. This is very attractive in a rehab setting because people in pain would likely tolerate low intensity exercise better than high intensity exercise. I can't have a 3-week post-op ACL from Dr. Lowe participating in high-low exercise. Okay, so this one's upright, cool. All right, so the current physiological theories on how blood flow actually works is that it stems around the metabolite production that occurs during exercise. So when you exercise with blood flow restriction training, you actually create a hypoxic environment. When you create this hypoxic environment, it increases the anaerobic activity or the anaerobic glycolysis. This increases your fast twitch muscle fiber requirements or your type 2s. That also leads to more increase in lactate production. And so when you get this positive reinforcement of more lactate production, you actually recruit even more type 2 muscle fibers, as well as it signals the brain to recruit more motor units and affect these following hormones. So you get an increase in growth hormone, which promotes collagen synthesis, which is vital for tissue repair and recovery. Additionally, you get an increase in insulin-like growth factor, which enhances the satellite cell proliferation. So you're able to get new myocytes that are actually added to the muscle that allows for the muscle to have growth, mass, and actually repair itself. You get a decrease in TGF-beta, which is just a protein that reduces muscle fibrosis and scarring after injury. And you also get a decrease in myostatin. Myostatin is a protein that inhibits muscle development, so actually decreasing the myostatin, you're allowed to have more muscle. Have any of you guys seen this bull? Does anyone know what it is? It's a Belgian blue. It's actually known for its physique. I didn't know a bull could be known for its physique, but these Belgian blues are actually lacking myostatin, so they pack on muscle very easily, which is surprising because muscle is metabolically expensive. Our body does not want to keep it around, but these bulls are able to live with all of this muscle packed on them. And it's found that high load training can increase muscle strength by 40%, and blood flow restriction training can increase muscle strength by 36%, which is pretty significant. The one that's asterisked at the bottom is an increase in mTORC1, which is your mammalian target of rapamycin complex 1. That is the most important pathway for increasing muscle hypertrophy. So under the right environment, so with protein nutritionally, you can actually get a significant amount of muscle hypertrophy. It is a consistent finding in the research that with blood flow restriction training, you can get hypertrophy in as little as 4 weeks, which is contrastly different from the traditional exercise paradigm where you typically don't get muscle hypertrophy until that 8-week mark. So we're able to cut off 4 weeks of strength training just by applying the tourniquet and participating in exercise. So how do we actually apply this modality? So in terms of frequency, what the literature's found is that it's best to do it 2 to 3 times a week. It has the largest effect size. That's even compared to when utilizing it for 4 to 5 times a week. That's thought to be due to potentially overtraining the muscle when utilizing this modality. In terms of duration, 9 to 10 weeks demonstrate greater changes, but you still get a large effect size with utilizing this modality for as little as 5 to 8 weeks. In terms of intensity, these patients are only exercising at 15 to 30% of their one repetition maximum. This is not something I'm actually having my patients do to calculate their one repetition maximum because that'd be very unsafe. So typically we utilize this OmniRes scale. It's a 0 to 10 scale, and so you're having them work at this 2 to 3 out of 10 difficulty range in terms of exercise. It's been validated and an effective in evaluating resistance exercise intensity. So it's an RPE that has a high correlation to the percent of the maximum volitional contraction and lactate accumulation. In terms of technique, we utilize a metabolite protocol This first set is of 30 repetitions, and that's the priming load for the Cori cycle that actually allows lactate to build up. After that, you do 3 rounds of 15, each with a 30-second rest break in between. And then once you're finished, the reperfusion of the blood into the limb kind of flushes out the lactate, and that burn that the athlete's feeling subsides relatively quickly. So when you have this patient finish just 75 repetitions of the exercise, it feels like they're running from a dinosaur. It feels like they've lifted to their actual capability, even though they're only lifting 2 pounds. And the reason why that is because you're trapping lactate. What they found is that when you utilize elastic bands or ACE wraps that you might see people utilize in the gym, it actually does not produce enough occlusion to have the same physiological effects. And it also can increase the possibility of nerve damage. So I'd highly recommend not just strapping ACE wrap as tight as you can around your arm and trying to get your biceps big for the summer. In terms of dosage, what we found is that the limb occlusion pressure is the minimal amount of pressure that's needed to actually occlude the arterial blood flow. So we're not actually exercising with no blood flow to the arm. For the upper extremity, we're exercising at 50% of that specific number, and then for the lower extremity, it's at 80%. And this is something that our tourniquet typically calculates for us. In the research, a lot of times when they don't have a tourniquet that collects the own limb occlusion pressure, some research is actually trying to utilize Doppler blood flow at the ankle while the tourniquet is inflated to figure out what the total limb occlusion pressure is. Otherwise, research is trying to start with 140 and seeing how the patient tolerates that millimeters of mercury of pressure. And typically we stick with one exercise per muscle group. So if it's an ACL, we're going quad, we're going glute, we might be go calf as well. So looking into the research, 2012 was the first real meta-analysis that established the efficacy of those previously described exercise parameters I had discussed. It validated when it's not feasible to lift heavy, like high resistance training, blood flow restriction training, it can maximize hypertrophy and strength gains. However, when it is possible, high load training is desired because there's something to be said about specificity of training. Your athlete eventually needs to learn how to lift big and lift heavy, particularly in contact sports such as football. In 2017, the British Journal of Sports Medicine, concluded that in their systematic review that the exercise parameters I had just mentioned were validated and effective. And they also determined that 69% of the population that utilized in general would have an improvement in actual muscle strength and hypertrophy. So it's very exciting effect size considering the global use of this intervention. So ultimately, blood flow restriction has the research and evidence to support and to be utilized in a rehabilitation setting for improving strength and muscle growth. So as I said, injury preventing and performance enhancing approaches that rapidly gain widespread use will always outpace scientific research. It takes several years to actually investigate the physiological effects of various stimuli with strong scientific methodology, data collection, and analysis, and ultimately determine if these interventions are appropriate, how they should be dosed, and who's gonna benefit from them. And one thing I did not want to mention was the power of placebo. When working with these modalities that might not be the most powerful scientifically, it might simply be best to educate the athlete and say, physiologically, it tries to provide the most opportune environment for healing to occur. Just because it might not be the best rated scientifically, doesn't mean you necessarily need to hypothetically kill Santa Claus in the eye of the athlete by telling them that it doesn't quite work, okay? And then any questions?
Kevin, I do.
Yeah.
Okay, as an athletic trainer, so many of us do things because we see a result. And I think, evidence-based today, we have to base everything on evidence. And so much of the stuff we presented today, like dry needling, there's not a clear-cut answer to it, and so on and so forth. What's your feeling and what's your findings that you've done in clinics as far as some of the dry needling, the things you talked about today, have you seen work and are useful in what you've done, even though the evidence may not necessarily show that?
Yeah, so I want to clarify, when we talk about evidence-based practice, it's not just what the research says, it's also what the clinician has found, what the patient has found or what the patient desires, and what the research says. So it's all three of those pillars. So you can't just take full stock into what the research says, because then you're missing two components of that triad. So while the research might not be the best behind it, clinically I've seen improvements with BFR and with dry needling. With cupping, I've had patients say, okay, I feel better, but I haven't seen significant change in how fast a baseball player can pitch. So I don't necessarily think I would be looking at the right measure at that time, but knowing, hey, from a clinical standpoint, I've seen benefits in pain and pressure tolerance with dry needling, and I've seen significant changes in muscle strength and hypertrophy with blood flow, I'd lean towards those two clinically. But as I said, if the patient comes in and their kind of expectation is cupping and needling, then unfortunately that patient's likely not going to get better until there's cupping and needling that happens on them for treatment. And just know that that is a big component of this triad of evidence-based practice. If you're not working on all three cylinders, you're going to miss the bucket somewhere. Does that answer your question?
Any other questions?
Yeah. Yeah. And so clinically, and we have a couple studies which ask if we're actually seeing this muscle hypertrophy and how we're seeing it clinically. We have a couple of research studies that are at the medical center that are actually looking at blood flow restriction in Dr. Lowe's post-op patients, as well as blood flow restriction with patients who have undergone intramedullary nails for like femur fractures. Unfortunately, we're measuring quadriceps like circumferential girth. However, we're not seeing these clinical hypertrophy measures. The research typically is stating that you can see it under MRI, but typically not clinically seen under girth measurements. But yeah, girth measurement would be a way I'd want to follow it long-term. So I wouldn't say I'm seeing it with my eyes. Unfortunately, it's mostly under MRI that we're able to demonstrate these changes. Any other questions?
Any other questions for Kevin? All right, I think we're moving right along. Thank you, Kevin.